In 2018, there was 22 million people need a kind of humanitarian assistance. And now, in 2019, the number increased to 24 million. So you cannot feed a nation. I'm so scared that to be here in 2020 saying that the number increased. This should stop. And I try to explain to the Congress that they can do a lot to stop the war in Yemen. It's a humanitarian disaster that they have the power to stop it. And they can get benefit from the power they have to do this.
Radia, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Radia Altamaco is chairperson of the Mo'atana Organization for Human Rights. Ruhan Nagra, executive director of the University Network for Human Rights. We're going to link to your piece, your report on the role of the U.S. in Europe, the role that it's played in the deaths of hundreds of civilians in the U.S.-backed Saudi-UAE-led war in Yemen. And thanks, Bill. We'll also link to your report. William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project Center for International Policy. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Denver March 15th at the historic East High School. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gesdert, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Massoud. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Tarina Nadura, Tamaria Studio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Voices from the Edge is off this week. Instead, we'll be airing Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio show, bringing you voices and ideas from struggle around the world. That's coming up next. At 9, it's Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire with Per Fagerang. At 10, on The Heather McCoy Show, Heather welcomes best-selling author Johann Hari to discuss his book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and Unexpected Solutions. At 11, Between the Covers interviews author Marlon James about his book, Black Leopard, Red Wolf. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk with Patricia Welch, Emma Ford, and Obie Hill.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO on Friday, March 8th for all-day special programming celebrating International Women's Day. For 24 hours starting at 5:30 a.m., the women-identified folk of KBOO will create special programming celebrating the accomplishments and struggles of women. Again, that's International Women's Day, Friday, March 8th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
It's 8:02, Voices from the Edge off this week. Instead, it's Final Straw Radio.
This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio show bringing you voices and ideas from struggles around the world. I'm your host, Bursa Goodness, broadcasting from occupied Cherokee land in southern Appalachia. This week, we're sharing two interviews. First up, I spoke with Glo Merriweather and Jamie Marsicano, two supporters of Raekwon Boram, a young black man accused by Charlotte PD of killing Justin Carr, another protester out during the Charlotte uprising after the police killing of Keith Lamont Scott in mid-September of 2016. Raekwon spent almost 2.5 years in pretrial detention, and his trial just began. Some witnesses to Carr's death claim the Charlotte PD killed him, not Boram. Check out our April 2018 interview with Glo, Jamie, and Ash for background on the case, and you can follow Charlotte Uprising at their Fedbook page. Second, we air an interview with Mia from Rising Tide North America, Selma from Ende Gelände, and Johanna from Climate Justice Action Camp in Germany about the tour the three are engaging around the so-called U.S. We talk about mass movements to stop the extractive industries in Germany and the U.S., the Yellow Vest Movement, the Green New Deal, and more. Tour dates and synopsis of the tour is up at risingtidenorthamerica.org under the title Scaling Our Climate Resistance. If you can't make the tour dates, there's also a free webinar on March 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern, which is up on that same site. If you're listening to the radio, we suggest checking out our podcast version up at thefinalstrawradio.noblex.org for an extra 40 minutes of interviews, as well as Sean Swain's segment on Portland PD working with Patriot Prayer and a couple of announcements. And here are a couple of announcements. Vegan anarchist political prisoner Eric King, who we focused on in our January 20th episode, has been moved again. Now he's at USP McCreary, about 20 hours drive from his wife and their kids in Colorado. And you can find out about donating to his commissary, his book list, find writings by him, and also the specifics about the tight mail restrictions at McCreary by visiting supporterickking.org. I'm joined by Glo Merriweather and Jamie Marsicano, two residents of occupied Waccamaw, Siouan, and Catawba territory, also known as Charlotte, North Carolina. They were on the show a year ago to talk about the Charlotte uprising after the police murder of Keith Lamont Scott. Glo has since had their charges dropped in relation to the uprising, and Jamie, Glo, and others have shifted their attention to the case of Raekwon Boerum. Mr. Borum's accused of the shooting death of Justin Carr in front of the Omni Hotel in downtown Charlotte during the uprising on Wednesday, September 21st, 2016. Thank you both for joining me to chat about Raekwon Boerum's case.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
So Raekwon was in pretrial detention at the Mecklenburg County Jail for about 2 years and 5 months, right? Is that like an abnormal amount of time as far as you know?
For us, we feel that any amount of time in a cage is abnormal for humans. But absolutely, we would say that the 2 years and 5 months is abnormal considering how many other uprising cases were funneled through the court and thrown out, and other cases, even within Charlotte, were funneled through the court and thrown out while he continued to sit in a jail cell.
We know that when he had his bond hearing, he was denied a bond. So there was no opportunity to even for his family or his community to get money together to get him out of jail, because he was just denied that opportunity.
And I've heard in the past that sometimes courts will like hold people for long periods of time because they're trying to get them to take plea deals. Does that seem to be a case in this instance?
I would
absolutely
yes.
agree with that. Even in my own case, if we hadn't paid the $20,000 in my bail, I would have been in jail, and it took them about 2 years to try my case. And in that 2 years, there were about two pleas offered. And at the end of my case, obviously, we found out that they needed to dismiss it because there was essentially no evidence, and I really should never have been arrested to begin with. So that's like a common tactic. We saw it with Khalif Browder, who, rest in paradise, in power, took his life after being forced in a cage and in solitary confinement, and pretty much just, I guess you could say, pressured multiple times into taking pleas so that the court can get their money and get all the different things that they would like under capitalism.
Yeah, and for Raekwon specifically, we've seen him be offered a plea of 16 years. So he's on trial for first-degree murder, which will be life in prison without parole. And he's been offered a plea for 16 years for second-degree murder multiple times. And each time he was offered that plea, it was coming right either during or right after he spent months at a time in solitary confinement. So they would put him in solitary confinement and then offer this plea. And I think we do believe that a lot of that has to do with trying to break down his spirit to get him to take this plea, because the police at all costs are trying to get Raekwon to take the fall for Justin Carr's death, because they know that the public is talking about how so many people were there, and from what they saw at the protest, believe that Justin Carr died at the police's hands. And so the police know that if they can't get Raekwon out for this, then they have to answer questions. And so that's why they're using these sort of suppressive and sort of back-breaking, spirit-breaking tactics to get Raekwon to either take the fall or take a plea.
Can you talk about your experience of what it means to try to muster a legal defense while you're behind bars, while your family is trying to support you from the outside and losing you as a part of their immediate community? Like, just what kind of extra pressure this puts on someone when they're battling against, you know, a prosecution that has basically unlimited resources?
Yeah, that is extremely, extremely daunting when you are, A, being you're currently kidnapped, you know, by the state, by the folks who want to keep you imprisoned, and they control when and if you can make phone calls. They control, and not even do they just control that, they also can surveil that, you know what I mean? And so, like, you lose a privacy, rights to your own body, rights to move when you're in that space. So when it comes to building a legal defense while you are currently in a cage, I can only imagine for Raekwon, it's been nothing short of what may feel impossible. Even with me being on the outside after I turned myself into the jail and got out and trying to build a legal defense, it felt very impossible at times. Just in terms of understanding that the state has really good control over media resources, and that media resources tend to trust the state over the folks who experience the thing or experience whatever event is being discussed or is on trial at the time. And so it kind of becomes like this really tough mental battle. And I know for myself, like I said, being on the outside, it was very, very damaging to, like, my mental health. And so I imagine that that is exponentially greater for Raekwon. Like, for myself, you know, just in witnessing Justin Carr's death and then carrying his body and then being placed on trial, and also knowing that Raekwon was in a cage after what I witnessed, like, that in and of itself is a really difficult, like, mental warfare to engage with, you know, daily, minute, second to second. I don't sleep, and I'm on the outside, so I can't imagine how sleeping on the inside is. I remember maybe it was last week, court literally had to stop because Raekwon was so heavily medicated with psychotropic drugs. And so it's kind of becoming like a very, it's pretty much warfare on his psyche and on his spirit and on his body.
A lot of these struggles with building a legal defense like you're talking about is systemic, and they happen like across communities in this occupied United States, right? Especially Black and brown communities. Because this is a frame up, Raekwon is facing like a very extreme conditions in terms of obstacles to building his defense. He was not able to get a local public defender when the charges were first happening and he was first arrested, because there were quite a few Charlotte public defenders who were on the ground during the protests and who tweeted about how they saw the police kill Justin Carr. And when that came out, after Raekwon was arrested, the state decided that it was a conflict of interest for Raekwon to be represented by a local public defender. So when they first got him a public defender, because he is poor and could not afford a private lawyer without community support, his public defender actually had to come from the state and not from the local public defenders, which already creates problems around like what the public defender may know about Charlotte and about the context of Raekwon's case. But also the lawyer that was assigned to him is a lawyer who had been disbarred for malpractice and not following the rules of law in past cases. And so that was very troubling for a lot of his family and community to see that there was all of this access denied to getting good legal representation from jump. And then as he sort of went on for the first year pre-trial, trying to work with this lawyer, he found that this lawyer was not representing his interests and was saying things to the media that he did not agree with, and was trying to convince him to take the plea that he did not want to take. So that was when the community really had to come together to try and find an alternative. And now he has great... great legal representation. I'm very confident in his legal representation now, but the obstacles to get there were so much greater because he is poor, and also because the state was working so hard to make it impossible for him to build a case for himself. And as far as the just real quick, as far as the medication that Glow was talking about, that's also been very troubling because his family has articulated that like he was never on medication before he was put in jail, and they started him on medication shortly after he came in jail. And so just seeing again all of the ways that they try to break down his ability to work on this case from inside.
I've heard that supporters of Raekwon have been facing a lot of suppression at court. Can you all talk about what his like outside support has been, what folks have been doing, and also what they've been facing from the courts?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think it's funny because it kind of goes in line with the suppression as well. So on the first day of Raekwon's trial, you know, I was there, Jamie was there, Ash Williams was there, and a few other supporters from Charlotte. And we heard the prosecution kind of make a motion to say that witnesses are no longer allowed in the courtroom, you know. And so considering I was a witness to Justin Carr's death, we figured out that pertained to me and also that I needed to leave. But I think it's also really important to highlight that there are probably a good 20 people who witnessed Justin Carr's killing, and the Charlotte DA's office never came to any of us. I have at least a good maybe like 10 people that I'm personally in connection with who were never contacted by the prosecutor's office from the day, you know, I said that I saw the shooting, right? And so it's been really interesting that only the witnesses who are saying that potentially it wasn't Raekwon Boreham, right? Because that's what the state is trying to say. If we're saying that it wasn't Raekwon Boreham, the state is now trying to make sure that, like, those witnesses can't even be present in the courtroom, but allowed, for instance, Justin Carr's mother, who will be called as a witness, to stay in the courtroom. And so it's kind of been interesting that on the very first day, I get banned. And then I'm pretty sure, Jamie, is it right that Ash got banned that day, or was it the next day?
Yeah, Ash got banned the first day because, so one thing we've seen is that this courtroom, this particular courtroom within the courthouse of Charlotte, is operating on different rules that the Charlotte courthouse does not typically operate on. So there's an extra metal detector. Like, you have to go through a metal detector to get into the building, and then they also have one set outside of the courtroom. I've never seen that in Charlotte before. They also are making it so that nobody except for the media can use any electronics at all in the inside the courtroom, even if they're on silent.
Can y'all give us some updates about, like, concerning the jury selection and the start of the trial? Like, besides the activity of, like, disrupting Raekwon's support and drugging him when he's come into the courtroom, are there any highlights or are there any things that are notable for listeners about how the court has been conducting itself or motions of the judge or anything like that?
Yes. For me, I feel like... It's almost like watching a game and the referee is rigged. That's how I feel about the judge, except it's not a game, it's a person's life. Over the course of the trial, there have been various motions filed by both the defense and the prosecution. And to my memory, I cannot recall one motion that the defense has filed that has been granted by the judge. And if I'm wrong, it's only been like one. Or two, whereas I feel like most of the motions that the prosecution has put before the judge have been granted. So, for example, the prosecution was the one who asked for the witnesses to be sequestered, and they were granted that motion. The prosecution also made a motion that in the defense's arguments to basically prove Raekwon's innocence, they motioned that they not be able or allowed to put the guilt of the death of Justin Carr on another. So in their defense, the defense attorneys cannot argue or provide any witness testimony that argues that CMPD may have killed Justin Carr, which is incredibly, incredibly limiting as they build their case, because so much of the witness testimony says that Raekwon did not do this because we saw the police do this, right? So that incredibly limits their ability to defend Raekwon. And then another big motion that happened this week was court was entirely halted because the police had been listening to Raekwon's jail calls and determined that they believed Raekwon had asked his family to take a hit out on the judge and to try to murder the judge. Upon further investigation, they found that Raekwon was simply talking to his family about a court protection spell, which is something that many, many people do: light candles, say a prayer, just try to protect their loved ones as they go through court. Something that so many folks without resources turn to spirituality and faith to support their people through court, right?
You've been listening to my chat with Jamie and Glow, two supporters of Raekwon Boram, who is currently facing a murder charge in relation to the Charlotte uprising of 2016, a popular response and upsurge in response to the Charlotte police killing Keith Lamont Scott. More info can be found at their Facebook page, Charlotte Uprising.
How has the media been handling the case so far? Like, what sort of representations have been coming out, and where have they been getting their information? Like, have they just been reporting what's been going on in the court, or getting info from the police department, or what?
The media coverage has been pretty much, it seems like it's coming from the court and very much swayed by whatever is happening on the prosecution side. For instance, when they first said the threats about Raekwon, the alleged threats, they were like, Raekwon Boram has halted court pretty much because he's putting threats on the judge's life. And then when they find out it was for a prayer and spiritual ceremony, the next story ran is that he threatened the judge with a voodoo hex, right? So it's like their language is it's describing him as very aggressive. It's describing him as very violent, when in fact, most people do. I personally did many, many prayers, ceremonies and rituals for my own case. And I know there are many like Black and Brown folks who engage in those kinds of practices that are outside of like white hegemonic Christianity. And so we're watching like how racialized media is, and how also it is very willing to be incredibly damning of a person who hasn't even completed their trial, because they are getting the majority of their information from the courts and from the prosecution, and actually aren't engaged or like necessarily encouraged to get the information from Charlotte Uprising side, because the Charlotte Uprising side isn't the side that's going to pay their bills. You know what I mean? And so like we pay attention to media in terms of like, we understand that it absolutely fuels capitalism. It fuels the prison industrial complex by criminalizing Raekwon's body from the moment he was arrested. The media in Charlotte was willing to say that he did this. And so we actually have never had fair stakes with the media here.
Well, you've mentioned Charlotte Uprising as a distinct thing other than the Charlotte Uprising events that occurred. Can you talk a little bit about Charlotte Uprising and how people can find out more about it and keep up on Raekwon's case there?
Yeah, Charlotte Uprising is a collective and like coalitional entity within Charlotte, and essentially a lot of the folks on the ground in Charlotte Uprising's core are trans and queer and Black, Brown, white, a very like large group of people. And then we have a few organizations who also team up with us, the Southeast Asian Coalition, and then other groups who like sign on to our work, like Comunidad Colectiva. And so essentially Charlotte Uprising is a group that works toward abolition and toward a more liberated and safer and transformed world. Like, our goal is our goal is transformation for our people, right? So transformation meaning moving from a world that is so incredibly punitive, and I don't mean the world globally, I mean the world that is constructed by the white supremacist colonialist United States, but trying to get us to a world that can be transformed around gender, transformed around economics, and like, why do we need capitalism? Why isn't everyone fed if we have enough food? Why isn't everyone housed if we have enough homes? And really getting folks into a space of being more community oriented, really gearing folks toward healing in our communities, because we also understand that the Charlotte Uprising was symptomatic of a lot of violence and of lot of hurt that has befallen LGBTQ communities, Black communities, Southeast Asian communities, Latinx communities, right? And so all of our people have been targeted by these systemic issues. And Charlotte Uprising essentially works to, like, get folks together, but also to tear that the down so that we can actually find something to work with. Charlotte Uprising does a lot around making sure folks understand that we're on stolen native land all the time. I feel we've done a good job of really making sure that we teach other spaces and other groups to recognize indigenous and native spaces. And so a lot of our work is honestly just undoing and decolonizing the shit that exists. Sorry, Jamie girl, I know I said a lot.
That was great. I don't have anything to add to that.
Great, it was on point. Where can listeners find out more or keep up on Raekwon's case? And are there ways specifically that folks that are interested can engage and show their support specifically to Raekwon?
Yes. So I would definitely take, if you're interested in following Raekwon's case, I would definitely take a peek at Charlotte Uprising's Facebook page, just Charlotte Uprising. I would say that that's the only place that is provide, besides now your radio show, that's providing sort of accurate depictions of what's going on in this trial. And from there, you can definitely find more information on how to support Raekwon specifically. This trial will probably last at least another week, maybe even two. So, of course, the most immediate way you can support is to connect with us, maybe via the Charlotte Uprising page, and come to court, or just to come to court. It's every day at 9:30 a.m. and at 2 p.m. In Charlotte at the courthouse in room 5370. But if you can't physically make it to court, there are ways to support Raekwon financially. We are still paying his lawyers. They're incredible, and have agreed to represent him amazingly, even without the full payment. But we still are raising money. And we're also raising money to keep his commissary stocked and make sure he has food and just all of his necessities while he's going through this court case. And you can find information on how to donate at the Charlotte Uprising Facebook page.
I just think it's really important to highlight how, for my case, for Raekwon's case, and I'm sure for most folks who find themselves up against the system in this way, for Mumia, for Asada Shakur, like, the media was ready to find us guilty even before any of us had trials, right? And so I think it's really important that we continue to stay grounded in the fact that, like, media actually plays a very large part in people being placed in cages or taken out of cages, right? Because the flip side of that is that because I was on the outside and able to run so much of my own media, I had Jamie, I had Micah, I had Ash, all my people with me. We were able to get our own narrative out there, but that required me working 24/7 on that, right? 24/7 concerned with my freedom, 24/7 for 2.5 years. And so just really paying attention to the amount of time that took, even for me to get my case dismissed, and how many people don't get their case dismissed just because they don't have the time to fight, you know? Maybe they don't even have enough community to fight. And so I think it's really important that platforms like your own and other platforms continue to reach out to us so that we can actually get Raekwon somewhat of a fair, I guess we could call it, community trial, right? Because we know that there are multiple trials that happen for people when they are caught up by the state. And there's the punitive court trial, but also what the community puts you through and what the community decides they do and don't want to believe.
Well, thank you both for coming on here and taking the time on such short notice, especially to have this chat. I really appreciate it. And I wish you solidarity.
Thank you so much for hearing us.
This is The Final Straw Radio, thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. I'm Bursa Goodness, and you're hearing Mia from Rising Tide North America, Selma from Ende Gelände, and Johanna from Climate Justice Action Camp in Germany, about the tour the three are engaging around the so-called U.S. under the title Scaling Our Climate Resistance. More info on the tour can be found at risingtidenorthamerica.org.
So I'm joined by folks affiliated with Ende Gelände and Rising Tide North America,
currently on tour around the so-called U.S. Would you care to introduce yourselves further for the audience?
My name is Mia, and I'm an organizer with Rising Tide North America. We're an all-volunteer collective of climate justice activists confronting the root causes of climate change.
And I am Selma. I'm organized with Energelände, and Energelände is a mass action of civil disobedience against lignite mining in Germany.
And I am Johanna. I am an organizer of the climate camps, which serve as sort of the starting place of Energelände and have drawn attention to the extraction of lignite directly in the Rhineland in Germany in the last year.
So we've had guests on the show in the past to talk about Hambach Forest as one example of lignite extraction in and the dangers of it in Germany. But would you all speak a little more about the climate camps and Energelände, like their structure or lack of structure or the way that they developed and came to be what they are now?
So the climate camps started 10 years ago. This is going to be our 10-year anniversary. And we sort of made the decision after the Copenhagen disaster, where so-called world leaders were not at all able to come up with a deal, no longer address politicians, but instead could go to the places where the destruction is happening. And that's why we decided in Germany to focus on coal mining, on lignite mining, which is the dirtiest form of energy production after tar sands. And Germany is, in fact, the world's biggest lignite miner. And the Rhineland, this is the region that the climate camps happen in, and Energelände has happened in most of the time, is actually the biggest source of CO2 in the whole of Europe.
Yeah, and Energelände usually is a guest on the climate camps. We gather there and do our action trainings, and then thousands of people. We try to enter the coal pits or try to block the railways or other lignite infrastructure. And usually we wear those nice white suits you might have seen and have lots of fun and try to stay there, yeah, to really annoy the energy companies and to produce pictures that show how these areas look like. These are very sad places. You can imagine this huge pit that is several thousand meters long, and this huge diggers who destroy nature, who destroy old forests, and we want to show the people that this is how the Germany's energy policy look like, and it's not that clean and renewable like our politicians like to present it.
Yeah, I think it would be really surprising for a lot of listeners to realize that, I mean, I'm surprised that to hear that Germany is the highest carbon output in Europe, because I mean, I know that there's been a lot of struggle over the years against the nuclear industry in Germany. Yeah, is this mostly used for industrial production, or is that energy footprint or that carbon footprint a product of consumer uses? And why do you think it is that the largest economy in Europe is still relying so heavily on such a dirty form of energy production?
We use it to produce energy. So 40% of the Germans' energy production is from lignite or hard coal. Yeah, we have these sort of energy since the 50s, and the utilities are well connected to politicians, political leaders, to the regions, many of the communities over there are dependent on these tax incomes, and they also hold shares from the company. So they have as well a big interest that this dirty business goes on.
And I think it's interesting to look at what industries we find in these lignite mining regions. Because specifically in the Rhineland and West Germany, we have a lot of arms industries, we have chemical industries, we have and steel industries. So these three are actually huge consumers of the energy that is produced there. And at the same time, they are industries where I think we as a society have to ask ourselves, is that actually what we want to build our societies on? Do we actually want to create our wealth on producing arms that kill people elsewhere in the world? Do we actually want to fund these enormous medical companies that produce so many things that we don't really need? Do we really want to have chemical industries that destroy nature and destroy people's livelihoods in other places as well? So I think there's still a lot of bigger questions around that.
And just to jump track a little bit, Mia, could you tell a little bit about the history of Rising Tide North America? Like, how is that structured, and how does it differ from, for instance, Greenpeace as a large organization that does, you know, anti-extractive work?
So Rising Tide is an all-volunteer network of climate justice activists, and it similarly came out of the European climate and anti-nuclear movement. In so-called North America, there are many local Rising Tide chapters that similarly are committed to confronting the root causes of climate change and advancing climate justice. Our organization, as a all-volunteer horizontal network, we really value autonomy and direct action and consensus-based organizing. And we have a strong emphasis on training, doing nonviolent direct action training, and supporting local groups and frontline groups in their struggles directly confronting the fossil fuel industry and other root causes of climate change. As an all-volunteer collective, men also have day jobs and do other things. And so we try to have strong and working relationships with many NGOs and many other community-based organizations and frontline groups that are organizing against the fossil fuel industry and against the drivers of climate change.
Yes, and historically, Rising Tide North America, as well as many local Rising Tide groups, have led campaigns doing direct action, directly stopping proposed or existing fossil fuel infrastructure.
So the TOR website mentions a just transition to decentralized and democratic energy systems. Can you all please talk about the visions for this, if there are any models you're excited by, and if there's any examples of implementation on whatever scale of these decentralized and democratic energy system techniques?
Yeah, so in Germany, this lignite and coal energy, but we have as well 40% of renewable energy, and especially at the beginning of this change or trend or implementation of these new technologies, the government subsidized people to have rooftop solar panels and to sell and use their own energy. And I think this was is still a very good example how we can empower people and connect people to the energy grid and make them as well aware of how energy is produced and that it's not coming from nowhere, that it's still, if you use renewables, based on resources and I think that was a good way. The sad thing about that is that recently it changed a bit. So the government now focuses more on larger projects like offshore renewable or offshore wind energy projects, which is mostly owned by the larger. We have four large energy companies in Germany, and of course, these projects
need more capital or more money to set them up. But yeah, at the beginning, I think it was a form of energy production which was more democratic and which enables as well more democratic structures, because if our energy production or our power production, you use in English the same word for it, I find it very interesting, is owned by only a few people, then yeah, power is in the hand of only those. And if we distribute it and yeah, bring people in power, then we might have a chance that our political system and social system as well can change.
And I think one thing that we try to model with the climate camps that we do every summer is we try to empower people to learn to actually work together. So all of the decision making we do on the camp, for example, is consensus based, and we invite everyone to join this and to get to know these processes. Because I think if we look at how we build the future and how we build the future of energy production, then we actually need to learn to work together. We know that not everyone can do everything at their home. So we have to network, we have to build resilient communities that are actually able to take decisions and to weigh the consequences of their decisions and to hear diverse voices, so that actually we are resilient against the risk that is coming at us with this climate crisis.
Is there any like positive models that that Rising Tide North America has adopted or addressed that you're excited about, or any tendencies that you may not be addressed by Rising Tide but you're personally excited about?
Well, I think this notion of who is in power is really important here. And so we're seeing over and over again that the fossil fuel industry and power companies are coming into communities and more or less ignoring the environmental and health and safety risks that they are bringing and trampling over the autonomy of communities to say what they want and what is healthy and what is fair for them. And so I think what's so inspiring about the renewable energy future is that it's a chance for us to reclaim power within our own communities. And while, yes, this transition can be great for local economies and great for the environment, I think it's this notion of communities working together and being able to make their own decisions about where their energy is going to come from, being able to weigh the pros and cons and make informed decisions is really, really inspiring. There's lots of things happening on the West Coast to change the laws and change the system to allow for more community-controlled renewable energy. We actually have to change the system to allow individuals and communities to have that control and autonomy. And so there's some really great efforts underway to legalize things like community choice aggregation or community solar that then will open the doors for local communities to lead the way. And one initiative or thing that I'm really inspired by are the Our Power campaigns of the Climate Justice Alliance, where local communities, frontline communities, are really developing their own visions and their own plans for what this just transition away from polluting extractive industry and towards resilient, renewable, sustainable energy and economies can look like.
One of the big talking points during this never-ending election cycle, like it starts earlier every year in the U.S., is the concept of a Green New Deal, and that sort of like it points to in its naming and in its inspiration to the New Deal. I wonder if Rising Tide has, or if you have any ideas about what sort of promise this sort of imposed from above wider plan for renegotiating how capitalism works with the environment, what it might look like and what it promises and what it fails to promise.
I think the notion of needing systemic change to renegotiate our relationship to capitalism to address climate change is the capitalist economic system, its need for never-ending growth to be consuming new resources, and it's fundamentally being powered by the fossil fuel industry, is completely incoherent with sustainable life on Earth. And so that reorientation or renegotiating or dismantling of the economic system, that shift has to happen with our shift to new forms of energy. I think that the Green New Deal is really, really interesting in how it's gaining so much traction at the federal level. We've seen time and time again that world leaders, so-called world leaders, have failed to put forward comprehensive climate policy. We've seen that at the Conference of Parties, and we've seen that at previous federal attempts in the United States to address climate change. And so I think while there is amazing dialogue and discussion and great things coming out of the Green New Deal, it's important to remember that so-called world leaders and politicians are not going to solve the climate crisis for us. It's going to be up to the people and to communities to lead that charge. And whether that looks like doing direct actions and sit-ins at their offices to build that political power so they have to support a grassroots vision for climate justice as federal policy, that is great. But it's also going to look like people doing mass resistance in the streets, at the sites of extraction, and creating locally the solutions, community by community, that we all want and deserve.
It may be a little late in this conversation for me to do this, but so this is a podcast that we're interviewing for right now. But as we said before the conversation started, also a radio show too. So people come across it by accident when they're driving in their cars, or you know, waiting at stoplights, or just at home cooking dinner, whatever. So assuming that new ears are listening that might could use some convincing from y'all, what the climate change landscape is looking like in the near future, and why the resistance that you all are proposing and engaging in is so necessary?
I think right now it is very, very clear that with the economic model that our so-called developed nations and Western sort of civilization is running on, we are headed towards catastrophic climate change. Catastrophic climate change means that we are basically headed for more than 2 degrees warming, possibly something between 3.6 to 6.8 degrees of warming. And anything that is warming more than 2 degrees actually means that we have no longer any knowledge about how our Earth's climatic system is reacting to the changes that then unfold through a series of feedback loops and tipping points. So basically, anything to be warmer than 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels of CO2 in the atmosphere is something where we have no control over what's going to happen afterwards. And I think that is an incredibly scary perspective. And we know that already 1.5 degree warming, that is the threshold that was agreed in the Paris Agreement at COP23 not to cross. That already means for a lot of island nations that they can no longer exist in the environment that their societies have been founded in. So people are losing their homes. People are losing their lives right now because of the climate crisis that is happening. And that is something that is entirely unacceptable. We cannot live in a world where one part of the world's population is living on the cost of the other. Basically, what our lifestyles mean right now is that we consume the lives of other people. And I think this needs to change. We need systemic change to counter that.
I think it's really scary to think about how human civilization and all of human history that we know of evolved and existed in a period of relative environmental stability. And in the last 100 years, and more notably in the last 30 years, we've so dramatically changed the atmosphere and the planet that we're actually living on an Earth that is a different Earth than where civilization and our cities and our societies developed in. And this uncertainty that Johanna is talking about, I think, is really, really important to note, because what scientists are saying is that we have about 10 years to completely transform our society, to completely move away from fossil fuels and other dirty extractive industry, and to become a more sustainable and holistic society. Or we are going to enter a world where no life will be untouched by climate change. If we don't dramatically change our society and our economy, a change that will improve the lives of everyday people, because the system as it is not working. So we have an opportunity to change a system to actually be a system that benefits the people, where everyone is treated as an equal. But if we don't do this, scientists are saying that in 10 years, we will enter an Earth unlike anything that any human has ever lived in, and that every life, every human, no matter where you live, will in some way be adversely impacted by climate change.
This is The Final Straw Radio, thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. I'm Bursa Goodness, and you're hearing Mia from Rising Tide North America, Selma from Ende Gelände, and Johanna from Climate Justice Action Camp in Germany, about the tour the three are engaging around the so-called U.S. under the title Scaling Our Climate Resistance. More info on the tour can be found at risingtidenorthamerica.org.
I think that's really powerful imagery that you're using. Like, when I'm listening to what you're saying, and you're talking about it's like we've crossed some dimension and suddenly put ourselves into some other place that is like more and more extreme than the prior place, more difficult for us to, even if we have all the wherewithal, the longer that we wait, it seems like the harder it will be for us to adapt, and the harsher the scenario will be for all of us, especially the most marginalized.
But that also means as soon as we act, whenever we do act, it will change the course and make things better. So I think an important takeaway is that resistance works and is necessary, and it's through mass and collective resistance that we're going to be able to prevent the worst of this crisis.
And I think, to me, it is always empowering to look at all of the examples that are already out there of what this world could look like. There are so many societies around the globe that actually live in a way that is sustainable, that is benefiting their communities, and that is good for everyone who is living on this earth. And even we in Germany, even we in the US, have solutions at hand that we can employ. We've been talking about democratically owned systems of energy production. Those solutions are out on the table, and it is up to us to employ them to create a situation where we actually have power over these systems, where we care for one another, and where we provide structures for our society that enable us to keep on living good lives and make good lives possible for everyone on Earth.
So I'd like to switch gears a little bit for just a second and ask how the tour's been, if there have been any conversations that you've heard started or that you've been able to engage in, any stories that you've heard on the road that have been especially interesting or insightful.
One thing that I think is particularly interesting from a European perspective is to see that so many of the struggles for climate justice in the US are led by indigenous groups. And we've had a lot of discussions with organizers about taking leadership from the most impacted communities and from the communities that actually have ownership over these places that we're in, and ownership of the places that the fossil fuel industry is trying to destruct. And I think it is absolutely crucial to work together from a set of diverse backgrounds and take leadership from those who are most impacted.
Yeah, when I joined Ende Gelände, I was at a point I felt that the problem is so big and I can't really change it. And then I was part of this mass action with 1,500 other people. And yeah, it was feeling, and it was a great experience. And I had, yeah, impression and the feeling and emotion that we can change that together.
One thing that I'd like to hear y'all's viewpoints on And maybe coming from those of you who are coming from Germany are a little bit closer geographically to what's been going on. But one thing that's been grabbing the headlines of certain media outlets has been the Gilets Jaunes. I might be pronouncing it incorrectly, but the Yellow Vest or Yellow Jacket movement in France. And my understanding is that it's somewhat of a response to a government neoliberal imposition of austerity on quote-unquote consumers, like mostly a lot of them working class people who are forced through capitalism to drive from here to there to get their jobs. Can you talk a little bit about what you think of what's been going on in the Yellow Vest movement in France, and if what that bodes for mass movement against ecologically destructive practices?
I actually lived in France, and I was there when the Yellow Vest movement started, and it was quite interesting to see how the movement developed over time, because it really started out as a movement of people who were opposed to higher taxes on gasoline. And then very, very quickly, when these people came together in the streets and started discussing about what their daily lives looked like and what the hardship in all that was, it turned into a much larger social cause. So what we saw there was that actually it is so important for people to gather and share experiences, because in this capitalistic system, it can so often feel like you are alone and it is your fault that you are facing these dire conditions. But actually, you're not alone. It is a systemic thing. Capitalism tries to individualize us, but actually what we are is a community. And I think it's so powerful to come together and realize that we are not alone. We are actually something much bigger than just individuals. And what these people then came up with was quite an interesting form of protest. So they blocked intersections, they blocked roundabouts, and they blocked toll stations on the highways. And what they did with that was disrupt the entire circulation of France. So there was times when you simply couldn't plan to get to another, which disrupted, in some sense, the entire economy, which definitely disrupted all of the political system. And it, I think, shows the power of mass mobilizations, that actually, if we just get large enough numbers of people out in the streets, out to critical points of infrastructure, then we are able to renegotiate the conditions that our society was founded on. And I think what was really important in that as well was the sense of community that people experienced. So it started out, the Yellow Vests movement was in part started by right-wing groups. But what they couldn't do was keep a stranglehold on the movement. So after a couple of weeks, we saw that actually the movement developed stronger left analysis of power. It developed analysis that didn't pit the people against other people, but it pitted the people against and a state that supports corporations and not all of the people that actually built together the foundation of economies and societies. And as soon as people started talking to each other and realized that it was not another group of people, another minority to blame for the problems of the system, but that it was actually corporations and the state that supported primarily these corporations, the narrative started to shift, and it shifted away from the idea that somehow migrants are responsible for the problems of our European economies, and actually started asking questions of what would our lives look like if we decided how the conditions of our society are instead of the state and corporations.
It's a lie that we've been sold here in the US as well, that climate change and other environmental problems are our fault as an individual, and that as an individual we have to solve it. But no amount of changing light bulbs or changing an individual consumer behavior is going to tackle the climate crisis. It's a system-wide problem, and we need systemic change. And I agree that that's what's so powerful about communities and people coming together in mass, because it the narrative and it changes that feeling. And when we go from being an isolated individual who is scared to being an empowered mass of people demanding and creating a solution, it's so empowering. And it's that's where my hope comes from, is when we get together as a mass group of people and resist what is causing our problems and create and demand the solutions.
So by the time that this interview airs, you'll have already traveled most of the way through the Pacific Northwest, but the next stop will be Grants Pass. Where are y'all going to be there, and what are some of the stops coming up after that?
Yeah, so for folks who want to get connected with the tour, there are a full list of dates as well as full event information on our website, which is risingtidenorthamerica.org. There you can get the full list of dates for all the events happening on the West Coast as well as in the East Coast and Mideast. We will be traveling from here down to Southern Oregon, speaking in Grants Pass. Following that, we're going to go to Humboldt State and then down to the Bay Area and Southern California. So please do check us out. And for folks who are interested in this topic but do not live where the tour is going, there's going to be a webinar on Monday, March 11th at 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. East Coast time, that is free and open to the public. You can get the RSVP link for the webinar on our website. Again, that's risingtidenorthamerica.org. And we'd love to connect with folks that are interested in building local resistance and scaling up our movement.
Mia, Johanna, and Selma, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. I hope you have a great rest of your tour with very inspiring interactions on both sides. And yeah, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care, too, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816.
Good morning. It's 9:01. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you all the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Fight the Empire with Per Fogarang. Per is going to be talking about Venezuela. At 10, The Heather McCoy Show welcomes best-selling author Johan Hari to discuss his new book, Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. At 11 on Between the